and welcome to the Comics Canon, the podcast that reads, reviews, and renders judgment on the greatest comic book stories of yesterday and today. In this episode, we get ready for the release of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, with a look at the franchise's comic book origins in Marvel Superheroes number 18 and Annihilation Conquest Star-Lord issues 1 through 4, published by Marvel Comics. Join us as we ask the burning questions: how good are these stories really? And do they belong in that body of great comic book works known as the comics canon? My name is Kevin Tick Morrow.
Ooga chaka, ooga ooga, ooga chaka, I am Kurt Holman.
All right. So
I spared you the singing of that and just thought I would just say it.
A grateful nation can send its thanks to letters at thecomicscanon.com.
Yeah. But obviously, we're doing our Guardians of the Galaxy episode. And did you know there was more than one team with the name Guardians of the Galaxy?
I did. And in fact, there are more than two, which we'll get into a little later. Mm-hmm. But as I mentioned, we're kind of doing this in conjunction with the upcoming sequel to the hit Guardians of the Galaxy film, and we thought that one of the easiest ways to dive into this was to sort of look at the origins of the aforementioned two teams.
Yeah, there wasn't really an archetypal Guardians story where it's like, well, this is the one we definitely have to do. There were some that we liked that the Guardians are in, but it didn't seem quite as Guardians defined.
So, and spoiler for our Spinnerack segment later, I'm a huge fan of the current version of the team, when it debuted back in 2008 by Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning. Mm-hmm. And I really like their run on the book a lot. Mm-hmm. But even so, like, I didn't feel that those books were quite... There was something that's just not maybe quite makes it discussion worthy for this, even though there are so many things in there that inform the movie, including, you know, Nowhere, the giant floating head of one of the Celestials and things like that.
There may be like great, that's the comics, there might be great stories and you love the dynamic and the gestalt, if you will, but there might not be, it's like, well, this is the obvious story to read just because there's a bunch of them and they're all kind of at a similar level or something like
that. Exactly. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But one thing that's funny is that the Guardians of the Galaxy are this obscure team based on even more obscure characters will be kind of jumping around a little bit, you know? So it'll be maybe a little more loosey-goosey than we often are when we like kind of drill down into a specific story. And this one, we'll talk about like some of like the kind of the publication history things a little bit and how this borrows from this and this borrows from that and kind of that kind of thing.
Yeah. So is there anything we want to mention specifically before we just jump into the first book?
Well, we should say that the biggest member of the Guardians we've already done already because we talked about the first appearance of Groot, I Am Groot, the Man Tree, you know, from Tales to Astonish number 13 in our episode number 19 from last year.
So, yeah, from in October.
Yeah, so you might want to listen to like that part of that episode if you want to have kind of the that first piece of the Guardians puzzle, basically.
Yeah, and I have a lot to say about Groot as he appears in the later story. Mm-hmm. But so let's go back to where it all began, mm-hmm. To a distant time and place, a distant time known as 1969, mm-hmm. With Marvel Superheroes number 18, and the story is called Guardians of the Galaxy. Mm-hmm. I'll run through the creators real quick. Writer Arnold Drake, mm-hmm. Artist Gene Colan, inker Mickey Demio, letterer Herb Cooper, and edited by the one and only Stan Lee.
In the year 3007, Jupiter's Charlie 27 returns from a long space militia mission to discover its home planet overrun by the evil alien Badoon. He flees via teleportation to Pluto, where he meets crystalline colonist Martin X. They team up to commit sabotage and flee to Earth, also under Badoon control.
The Badoon commander interrogates Major Vance Astro, a 20th century astronaut who spent 1,000 years on ice, as well as his companion Yondu, a humanoid alien. Vance and Yondu's escape attempt coincides with Charlie 27 and Martin X's arrival, and once they realize they're on the same side, they become rebel fugitives under the name the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Da-da-da-da. So it's funny how this story predates some of the oldies music that's in the Guardians of the Galaxy movie. You
know? True, yeah.
One thing that's kind of funny that struck me is that I don't know if Marvel had a ton of strictly space-based heroes at this time. You know, they would have like characters like Thor and Fantastic Four who would go to space a lot. But I don't know if they had people like Green Lantern whose job was primarily in space, or Adam Strange or someone like that. So this reminds me of kind of a Adam Strange type story in a way, even though it's like kind of a one self-contained kind of thing. And they did have another space-based hero in Captain Marvel, who was introduced in 1967 and also drawn by Gene Colan, who would become kind of important in kind of the cosmic Marvel stuff that would kind of get launched a few years from now, basically, in like the early 70s.
Yeah, yeah, aside from him, Marvel, there wasn't really a lot to work with.
Yeah.
And I don't want to kind of spoil some of my thoughts on this story, but even though it ends on a cliffhanger, it doesn't really feel like they put a lot of thought into this, like they're launching a new team necessarily.
Yeah.
It reads just like any of the other kind of anthology books of the period that are just kind of throwing concepts out there to see what sticks and what doesn't. But anyway, we can get into all that. So we start with Charlie 27.
Yeah.
And Kurt, do you think that he's the 27th guy named Charlie, or that 27th is his code name?
That's a very good question.
His surname, rather?
Yeah, yeah. Well, my bigger question is the fact that they apparently live on the surface of Jupiter, and it's like, Jupiter being a gadget, it's like, how is that? The hand wavy kind of, don't worry about that, you know.
It's the 30th century.
Yeah. But one thing that's kind of funny is that he is kind of our introduction to the story, and is kind of the relatable guy, you know, and he's kind of there's a sort of a tradition in comics where like the big strong character like isn't the more cerebral or remote one, but it's kind of the down to earth one, or down to Jupiter in this case. and so it's kind of funny that like he's sort of our entry point, where you have a guy from the 20th century who isn't in this case.
Who would make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
The aforementioned Vance Astro.
Yeah.
Who has his own curious history. Mm-hmm. So he's from the 20th century.
Yeah.
Ends up in the 30th century in a book that I think a story that you and I both like a lot, mm-hmm. the Avengers Korvac saga.
Yeah.
They come back. These guardians come back to the past to watch over young Vance Astro, even though the adult version is still with them.
Yeah.
Also, Kurt, I hate to do this to you. This is going to be the first of many references to a favorite of mine,
okay.
Marvel's Micronauts series from the 70s.
Yeah. I would say that, like, let's make a pact, and the last episode of this podcast will be about Micronauts.
Well, let's not be too hasty. Doesn't have to be the last one. You never know. We might have a contest.
Well,
wins the contest.
We can do Micronauts before, but then the last one can be Micronauts. It's another Micronauts episode.
Okay.
Anyway, sorry. Enough of Micronauts.
Yeah. So, it's funny because the main character in that story, his story, his background is pretty much lifted completely from this. Mm-hmm. Arcturus Rann, who is a space traveler, who has been gone on this 1,000-year voyage, mm-hmm. and comes back to a world that is, you know, kind of pretty much forgotten him. And then he sort of becomes the leader of the Micronauts, blah, blah, blah. It's a whole thing. And anyway, some kind of funny echoes.
Well, it's they're both specifically from Buck Rogers in the 25th century, I think,
right.
that we would know, which was like one of the Flash Gordon era serials that would later inspire Star Wars. But the funny thing is that Vance Astro is kind of weird in this, or at least his predicament is kind of weird, because as they say in his origin, you know, he gets sent off, you know, on this long mission, and they has to go by basically like Einsteinian space, you know, and he's going to be the first one to get to this planet and stuff like that. And he's in this copper foil suit, And if he takes the suit off, he'll like age 1,000 years and die, you know. So he lands on the planet 1,000 years later and finds people are already there. And someone says like, well, we invented Harkovian physics. And so we just got here sooner, but we couldn't stop you. So you're a hero. And he's like, but this was all for nothing, you know. So,
yeah, and that's a little hand-wavy too. Like yeah. There was no way that they could wake him up and stop his voyage.
Yeah.
And it looks like they pretty much just pack him in ice inside the rocket ship.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's like in a chest freezer, basically. Yeah. So
that's some pretty hardcore stuff that's going to stay preserved for 1,000 years.
Yeah, yeah. But it's interesting that he's not the reader surrogate, even though he's, you know, from our time. He's like, has this weird predicament. He's got these brain powers that aren't really explained too much here. And I always seem kind of vague to me in kind of the subsequent appearances, but he's got like psychokinesis and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, we kind of jumped ahead and we'll jump around a little bit because it's a very simple story. But one of the funny things about the first part is when Charlie 27 arrives in Jupiter, sees the Padoon has taken over. He's like, oh my God, all my friends, including my father, are being sent to this like radiation mine. I've got to save them. And the Madoon's like, oh, there's one, you know. And he's like, maybe not. Maybe I'll come back later. You
That's
know?
True. And I like how he just happens to see his father in the van that is like conscripted a lot of them and is hauling them away. Mm-hmm. He's like, that's my dad.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so the courage of his convictions doesn't last very long. And he runs to the nearest teleportal device, which begs a question to me. He's just come back from a 6-month space militia mission.
Yeah.
It's like, why are you doing that if you could just teleport anywhere you want?
Well, maybe they have to go out where they don't have the receiving end of it. Maybe it seems like that they teleport, that it's a closed system, basically.
Yeah, so, that's true. Yeah.
But he leaves and meets Martinex, who is all like kind of, he looks like he's made out of crystal, basically. I keep wanting to call him Terminex, which wouldn't be a pro. And they have like, they mention like slurs of the future, like I think they're called rockheads, you know, but they don't, it seems like Charlie 27 is more enlightened than that, but there's like, you get a sense there's some, you know, bad feeling, you know, but it has these humans who have been kind of genetically changed to live on these theoretically difficult environments like Pluto and Jupiter, you know.
Yeah, and it's a very legion of superheroes too, in that they each have specific abilities that correspond to the environments that they've been raised on.
Yeah.
So Charlie 27 is just like really big because he's from Jupiter, and dense and presumably strong. Mm-hmm. I don't think you get any sense here that he's super strong. Mm-hmm. Martinex, I guess, our Pluto colony people evolved into these crystalline beings somewhere over in the course of 1,000 years, which
it's like
seems like it might be a little early for that.
But it's like it's cold, so they have temperature powers, basically. Yeah. Yeah. And we'll introduce the fourth one, who is Yondu, who is when we meet at Vance Astro, Yondu's with him. And they have kind of a Lone Ranger and Tonto kind of vibe. I mean, Yondu seems very much in this like a Native American character in a way. He doesn't, his command of English is a little shaky.
Yeah, there's one point where when we meet them, the Badoon Emperor is talking to Vance Astro, and Vance Astro, you know, wants him to come over to their side, and Vance Astro pretends to give it some thought, and, you know, like he's going to sell everyone out. And so when they inevitably, you know, show their true colors, and then they fight and they run away. Yondu's like, why you say them ugly things about me, Copper Man?
Yeah.
I was like, ooh.
Yeah, yeah, it's not great. But we should say that Yondu is obviously the only character in this story who's in the movie version, and he's very different from the Michael Rooker version of Yondu, who is kind of this space pirate. And this Yondu, he seems kind of from a not as highly technological society, maybe. And he's got, instead of like this little kind of mohawk, you know, on his head, he's got this like giant fin.
Yeah.
And, but he has the same kind of arrow whistling power where he shoots a bow and arrow and you can whistle and control where it goes, which is like, it's kind of like the one bit of this comic's DNA that's still in the movie version, basically.
Yeah. And, they don't mention it here, but later on it's, through the, you know, as the character evolves, it's mentioned that he is a Centaurian, and I think, you know, as an Alpha Centauri. And I'm, you get the sense that he looks more like an alien than an actual, you know, offshoot of an Earth colonization, but whatever.
Yeah, that's neither. I think it's meant that he's supposed to be an alien, even though he's like very humanoid, you know, so they all look, you know, basically none of them look like regular, you know, 21st century human beings, you know, but so they're all kind, there's no quote unquote normal human one, you know, on, you know, so. And it, you know, not a lot happens in it beyond this kind of run, this running around the solar system and then finally kind of assembling the team, you know, the, I was thinking about the Badoon are kind of like generic evil aliens. The word bad is the first part of their name, you know.
And it's unfortunately close to baboon. And, yeah, I was thinking a little bit about the Badoon who have never really caught on in the way that the Skrull or the Kree or even the Shi'ar or the Shi'ar, however you're supposed to say it, are or have. And they've you know, they've been brought back several times, but they never just seem to get up to the level of menace that, say, the Skrulls do. They're very much like the B-team of space conquering bad guys.
It doesn't help that they look kind of like the Skrulls, but they don't have the same powers. So just on a design level, it's like, well, if we're going to have this, we might as well just have the Skrulls. So, yeah, I got to say, I'm not crazy about Gene Colan's art in this. It feels like a, not a perfect match.
I agree completely. It, even though, as you mentioned, he's done other space things. Was he on Captain Marvel? Is that right?
Apparently, he's like the first one. Apparently,
He had worked on Daredevil. He had worked on, you know, he had done Dracula, which he was much better suited for. Things like that. Here, it just doesn't seem to work.
Yeah, I mean, I liked his sort of street level aspect of his Daredevil artwork, and this, it seems, it doesn't seem to quite fire the imagination the way the sort of future space story you would hope it would, you know. One of the things about the final panel, it has the ends with the kind of a nod to the politics of the day, with the Guardians singing "We Shall" or "Earth Shall Overcome" to the tune of "We Shall Overcome," which, you know, "We Shall Overcome" having been, you know, one of the anthems of the civil rights movement. And when I remembered this story from, like, when I read it in the past, in my memory, this was like a two-page spread with them standing there singing that. And at the end, it's just like one panel at the bottom of the page. So it's like, maybe there's another time they appeared. I don't think they sang, but maybe I'm transposing two different images, you know, in my in my memory. But it kind of obviously stuck with me a bit because I remember them singing that at the end of this, you know, from when I read this, like, you know, I was like not old enough to read it when it came out, but, you know, read it like sometime in the 70s.
So we're not going to spend a ton more time on this, but real quick, I want to talk a little bit about the characters and just the pace of the action, if you will. So as we mentioned, he the writer on this is Arnold Drake, who famously co-created the Doom Patrol. And there are some similarities here in terms of bizarre characters. Vance Astro is trapped in his copper foil suit that is colored like copper colored, which is not, you know, very exciting to look at. You know, and so there's an echo of Robot Man from the Doom Patrol in that a little bit. But the Doom Patrol, which was created in 1963, is much better realized than this. And the characters, you know, obviously they go on, they continue, they gather more depth as they start, but you don't really feel a lot of closeness to them either. And part of that is because this story is so condensed and it moves really quickly. And the whole scene on Jupiter with Charlie 27 and his dad and the radiation mines and everything, there's so much going on. It happens so fast. It's hard to be engaged. I can't help but think how this would have read as like a four-part miniseries. And that first part being its own first issue, you know, maybe introduce some of the other characters. So anyway, that said, unless you have anything else you want to talk about this.
No, I think we should move on, and I think we can bring this up when we get to the reckoning later. One of the things I wanted to mention in terms of transitions is that you know, after the Guardians appeared in this story, they appeared in Marvel 2-in-1, which is kind of the Things team-up book and the Defenders title. And the story is written by Steve Gerber. And Steve Gerber's most famous creation from the 1970s was Howard the Duck. And Howard the Duck appears at the end of Guardians of the Galaxy. So I wonder if that's like a coincidence or if there's some kind of other connection going on there.
A nod to that, yeah.
Yeah. We should say that in 1972, Jim Starlin joined Marvel Comics, and he became the creator of Thanos, Gamora, Drax the Destroyer, and was kind of like the guy who whose vision for kind of the cosmic Marvel stories influenced kind of all the cosmic Marvel stuff that like kind of came after it, or virtually all of it. And his influence is sort of all over the Guardians movies and, you know, presumably, you know, the X-Men Infinity War movies and stuff like that. Yeah. Ironically, we haven't done a book by him yet, and is not going to really talk about him now, but we wanted to just kind of shout out that he was going to come and be a big deal, you know, in that part later.
Now, retroactively, it's hard not to see him in a lot of this stuff because we know that things like, you know, the Guardians of the Galaxy with Gamora and Drax are coming. Also Gerber, Bill Mantlow, who co-created Rocket Raccoon with Keith Giffen and wrote, not coincidentally, the Micronauts.
Yeah.
created Bug, for example. And also Steve Englehart, like they're all over kind of this episode, especially in the story that we're going to talk about.
Yeah, well, since you brought it up, we'll just mention that. Well, it's funny, like 1976 was a year that saw the introduction of both Star-Lord, aka Peter Quill, and Rocket Raccoon in different books. And they were like never super popular, you know. I mean, there was like kind of, they would kind of appear a little bit, but I saw something that said that Rocket appeared maybe like 10 books in the first 30 years of his creation. And there was like a 22-year-old gap when like Star-Lord didn't appear. And then, but both of them, you know, were brought back in the 2000s, you know. So it's funny how like, how many of these were created in the 70s, even though they didn't have very big splashes in comics culture until kind of more recently.
Yeah, the first time I came across Rocket Raccoon was in Bill Mantlo's Hulk run. Mm-hmm. In either the late 70s or the early 80s. And of course, like I said, he had co-created that character. So it was just dragging him with him.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm going to force him into the Hulk somehow. And it worked pretty well.
Well, and it's funny that Keith Giffen drew him in his first appearance, Rocket's first appearance, and is now writing him in the story where we're doing, where it's almost, it's like people kind of like, is it a coincidence or is it kind of an editorial decision, you know, that, you know, well, we want to bring this character and you happen to be doing it. So, you know, it's like, or does they say, it's like, yeah, I want to do this and I want Rocket Raccoon to be here because I helped create that guy, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, we should say, the Star-Lord miniseries that we're talking about was part of a kind of a little event called Annihilation Conquest, which was a sequel to this other event called Annihilation, which involved the Annihilus and his forces from the Negative Zone invading our universe and attacking the Kree and the Skrulls and causing all kinds of hullabaloo, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it kind of, it's like it brought in all these, you know, cosmic characters and, you know, changed the board around. And then Annihilation Conquest came to have like this whole other thing that kind of did basically the same batch of stuff. You know?
Yeah, you called it a little story, but it's actually rather complex. And we had talked about maybe doing that storyline eventually as one of the possibilities for this episode. Mm-hmm. And there's way just too much going on.
Yeah.
And you could just do the standalone miniseries. Mm-hmm. But there's so much that feeds into it, like this, there are like three different four-part miniseries. I don't know that they all have four parts, but they're like, there's Annihilation Conquest Wrath, and there's one with Quasar.
Nova, too, had that.
Nova, that's right.
Because Gamora and Drax, later meeting the movies, are not in the one we're going to talk about, but they're in the Nova one, and then they get pulled in, you know, when it's all over, you know.
Yeah, I'll have something to say about Nova later, too.
Yeah, okay.
One thing I do want to mention real quick is the prologue that sets up Peter Quill's involvement in all of this after Annihilation. He's in pretty good with the Kree and Ronan the Accuser, who you might remember from the Guardians movie, and he's a pretty big deal in the Kree world, even though the Kree are very much, you know, sort of full of themselves. Yeah. They have this kind of distasteful kind of racial purity thing where like the fact that he's a human and Ronan the Accuser is giving him this position of power within his administration doesn't sit well with a lot of people.
Yeah, Ronan's a bit more complicated in the comics.
Absolutely,
he's kind of a, I kind of enjoy Ronan in the movie, but he's kind of a conventional terrorist villain, essentially just an alien, you know. And Ronan's kind of a leader of the Kree, so he kind of like walks, or a leader, and he kind of walks this line between good and bad and working, you know, his planet's interests versus the greater good and things like that. You know?
Yeah.
So in kind of the buildup for this, you know, Peter Quill is kind of on the good side of the Kree, but then this thing happens. And should we get into our plot summary now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so the creators for Annihilation Conquest Star-Lord, written, as we said, by Keith Giffen, artist Timothy Green II, inks by Victor Olazaba, colorist Nathan Fairbairn, letters VCs Russ Wooten, assistant editors Alejandro Arbona and Lauren Sankovich, and editor Bill Roseman.
Okay. Star-Lord 1. When robotic aliens called the Phalanx conquer Kree space, human Peter Quill is drafted to command a team of expendables to destroy the Phalanx's development system to prevent it from spreading further. Quill's ragtag team includes Galactic Warrior Bug, Deathcry of the Shi'ar, Mantis, the self-proclaimed Celestial Madonna, Captain Universe, a.k.a. Gabe Vargas, human possessor of the Unipower, munitions expert Rocket Raccoon, and talking Kree alien Groot. Quill reluctantly agrees to resume his Star-Lord mantle and lead the new team on a likely suicide mission.
Issue 2. Team Star-Lord Issue 2. Let me give it a look. Issue 2. Team Star-Lord infiltrates the capital of the Kree planet Hala using low-tech supplies to avoid Phalanx detection. The team encounters stragglers from the Annihilation Wave who draw attention from the Phalanx's sentry drones. When Captain Universe kills one of Deathcry's opponents, she attacks him to avenge the insult, and he kills her in self-defense. Groot sacrifices himself so the team can escape. Quill tells the traumatized Captain Universe that he did the right thing.
Issue 3. 2 days later, Quill passes incognito among the citizens and determines that the Phalanx is spreading by an airborne nanovirus, turning the Kree into, quote, techno-zombies, end quote. A surviving sprig of Groot catches up to the team in the tunnels. Deadly maintenance drones chase the teammates from their hiding place. Captain Universe sacrifices himself so the team can escape to a populated level. Drones capture the team, who surrender rather than risk killing civilians. Mantis flees and reveals that Captain Universe is still alive.
Issue 4. The imprisoned teammates await their fate. Mantis suggests Captain Universe use the Uniforce to track down the Phalanx's cure for the nanovirus. Mantis springs the team, who shoot their way out and find allies among Kree guards. A member of the Phalanx becomes a new host for the Uniforce, which finds the cure and returns to Gabe. The reunited team steals a ship, destroys Phalanx pursuers, and successfully escapes. Back at their base, the Kree commanders cure the Phalanx infection, but they have plans for further missions for Quill's team.
One thing that's funny about this is, like, I remember very well reading it, it kind of the late part of the decade, like 2009 or so, maybe 2010, a friend of mine had loaned me the issues of it, and I was kind of going along. And there's that part where they've like introduced all the characters, you know, and sort of this, the Kree female, their kind of Kree boss, Captain Chandar, they're talking about how they're training, and they're saying, like, you know, well, the raccoon is great. They see him like shooting this crazy machine gun going goo, 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 goo. And it's like, and Quill's like, you know, well, how is he going to carry a machine gun? And the other one's like, you know, well, he's become friends with Groot and he's just going to carry it for him, you know, like a heavy ordnance transport. So there's a picture of Groot holding Rocket in his hand and Rocket shooting the gun. And I remember like sitting on the sofa with my wife and saying, look at this. Isn't this crazy? You know? And then like 5 years later, it's in a movie trailer, you know, Groot on top, or Rocket on top of Groot shooting a gun. And it's like, anything from a comic can be in a movie now. It's like, there is no limitation, you know? So,
I like this considerably more than I did the one that we just talked about.
There's a lot to like about this.
Yeah. So The Phalanx, they're not like a particularly imposing threat in this story. I think when you read the larger Annihilation Conquest event, that they, you know, you get a truer sense of menace from them. But they're a cybernetic race. They're very much like the Borg.
Well, the collection that I was reading from has a thing on the back that says, when your land is occupied, you have two choices: assimilation or resistance. And resistance is futile, you'll be assimilated, or like the Borg catchphrases, you know.
Yeah.
They're kind of like the AI in the movie, the Matrix movies, which had the squid sentinel things.
Yeah.
And they're a little like the Brainiac in kind of the 80s version, where Brainiac had kind of the skull metal face, you know.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like those, basically. They're not the most fresh or imposing villains to me, frankly, you know.
No, and they're tied to the Technarchy from Chris Claremont's New Mutants run, the character Warlock.
Yeah.
They're sort of an offshoot of that. And they had a popular, I don't know how popular it was, but they had a big event in the 90s, the Phalanx.
Yeah.
But as you can tell, you know, by their rather generic name that has nothing to do with, you know, their actual purpose or, you know, their kind of concept. They're just kind of, you know, they're a step away from generic. They remind me visually. I do like how they look visually, and they remind me a little bit of the Dominators from the DC Invasion storyline that we mentioned last episode briefly. But they get the job done.
Yeah.
You know? And like I said, they're a little more imposing in the larger Annihilation Conquest event, but still, they're like the Badoon. They're kind of like a B-team villain. And spoiler alert, it turns out that Ultron is behind all of this somehow. And that makes it a little bit more palatable, although none of that has anything to do with what we're talking about here.
Yeah, the Ultron reveal only comes later, basically.
Yeah.
You know, I'm actually not a big fan of Ultron either, which doesn't really help me that much. But I think that the team dynamics are basically, you know, what's the appeal of this. You know?
Yeah, I really like this team and the different corners of the Marvel universe that they draw from. I like this Star-Lord a lot. When I was a kid, I read a Star-Lord story, not the first one, but one in like Marvel Premiere or Marvel Spotlight or Marvel something or other, one of those anthologies. I just kind of remember it being a pretty generic space opera story, and whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a guy flying around shooting aliens, whatever. It looks cool to me. I like him here where he's, you know, self-aware, and calling himself out on, you know, the ego and hubris that he used to have, you know, when he was parading around the galaxy, calling himself Star-Lord and poking a little fun at his origin story, where he's, you know, kind of selected by someone called the Master of the Sun, someone or something, you know.
I saw the Masters of the Sun at Woodstock, and you know, it was awesome. Steve Englehart, in fact, said that when he introduced the character, I'm quoting, it's like, my hero would go from being an unpleasant, introverted jerk to the most cosmic being in the universe, and then he kind of left Marvel before kind of carrying that out. So he started off with this difficult personality, which kind of morphed into like the movie Peter Quill to this sort of lovable, immature rogue, basically, who's kind of, I don't remember the early ones a lot more, but you know, he's kind of a lot more likable now. Mm-hmm. And he's pretty fairly likable in this. He's kind of got this, he's trying to live down what he did as Star-Lord.
Yeah.
So he's got this sort of, I have to atone for this thing that I did, you know, which is kind of, you know, standard issue. But
it works, you know, and it makes him a lot more likable. And he has this kind of, I want to call it a Kobayashi Maru sort of situation that brought him to this point, just because we were talking about the Borg and Star Trek a minute ago. But his hubris got the better of him, and he got into a situation where he ended up in a kind of sacrificing the few for the many scenario, which was very horrific and caused him to leave all this Star-Lord nonsense behind. And like I said, I like this Star-Lord character. I like the one in the movies too, but I like this one so much better. And it bugs me a little bit that he's becoming more and more like the movie version.
Yeah.
And a little less like this version.
That's always a risk. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't fault Marvel for doing that, as they've done with a lot of characters who have shown up in the movies, and they try to draw them or fine-tune their personalities a little bit so that they won't be completely unrecognizable to people who pick up a book after having seen a movie.
Yeah.
Whatever. But I want to mourn, you know, the gradual dissolution of this Star-Lord character a little bit.
Yeah. One thing, they don't overdo the atonement redemption kind of thing with him. I mean, in the first issue, he the Kree tells him, like, you know, we want you to be Star-Lord again because as a symbol, it, you know, means a lot to a lot of people. And so he has to kind of like put on the uniform again. He looks himself in the mirror and kind of like sighs. Yeah. It's not like he has like kind of an anguished Chris Claremont, Stan Lee monologue about,
no, I must never do this again. No,
and the one thing is, and his team ends up wearing like a version of the same uniform, which is kind of funny, you know.
So let's talk about the team, since we said we like this collection of characters, or at least I said that.
I'd say I don't like all of them.
No, but I like how they put it together. So you've got Bug, who's and Captain Chandar is like kind of, you know, introducing everyone in a very cinematic style as she's walking past all their cells. And we should mention they're all Kree prisoners for some contrived reason or another.
Yeah, it's not that different from in the movie when they're prisoners of the Nova Corps, and you know they're introducing them all and kind of saying their dossiers. You know.
Yeah. So one of the names that she mentions for Bug is Galactic Warrior, which was the name of one of the Micronauts toys in the 70s, and the Bug character was given that designation to kind of tie into the toy line, even though the toy looked nothing like him, which turned out to be a smart move, whether it was, you know, there was foreknowledge or not. It turned out to be a smart move on Marvel's part, because eventually the rights to the toy characters, Marvel lost them, but they were able to keep Bug because he was enough of a, you know, unique creation, as opposed to, say, Biotron or Microtron, who had, you know, toys that looked with the same name and the same likeness, and, oh, well, you can't use them anymore.
Well, that's, you know, would it have been that different if we'd lost Bug? No, because I will say that,
I have a lot of fondness for Bug.
I like Bug in this, but he's kind of not that different from Star-Lord. He's a little bit more extroverted and overtly funny, but Star-Lord's kind of funny too, and they're both, and Bug is kind of pretty human looking, you know. He looks kind of bug-like when he has his helmet on, and he looks, frankly, kind of like Ambush Bug, who is a Keith Geffen character, who's like a humorous character, who we'll talk about maybe in detail on another episode, but I'm a big fan of Ambush Bug, you know, DC character, who maybe there's this elaborate homage going on, maybe not, you know, but it's almost like, I don't know if we need both of them in this, but, you know, not a big deal. Yeah,
that's fair. I disagree, but I could see your point.
And in the more recent versions he's appeared, he looks a lot more alien and not humanoid, basically.
Yeah. You know? Oh, and it just occurred to me that I never did follow up and explain why I made that tick noise during my introduction. See, one of Bug's distinguishing characteristics is that he has this habit of, well, I'll let the Marvel Wikia website explain it. Bug's speech is interspersed with a tick sound due to an insectivorid's chitinous membrane in the throat. The insectivorids are the race that he comes from. So anyway, this means that his word balloons read like, have a little faith. We're the tick good guys. The good guys always tick win. It's sort of a vocal tick, if you will. It's never bothered me, but I've heard some people say that it's distracting and it takes them out of whatever book they're reading that he's in. Anyway, then we have Mantis. According to Wikipedia, she ranked number 99 in the Comics Buyer's Guide list of the 100 sexiest women in comics. So, for what that's worth.
Do that for what you will. Yeah.
Are we sure that's not Wizard? I don't know if you remember a Comic Buyer's Guide in its heyday. You know, it was like a newsprint.
Oh, thing I remember it, yes.
It seemed a little more serious than to have like a kind of cheesecake 100 sexiest comic character, female comic characters thing. But hey, whatever keeps the lights on. Yeah. You know, I've certainly worked for places that have done some questionable issues, so I can't cast any aspersions. So anyway, Mantis, created by the aforementioned Steve Englehart, has a bit of a convoluted history. Originally, she was supposed to give birth to something called the Celestial Messiah, and you know, stuck around after that in various forms.
She was big in the Avengers for a while.
Yeah, there's
and
a,
like Kang the Conqueror was popping in and out, and she married the swordsman in this big thing, I think. You know,
And there's a collection of the Celestial Madonna story, if I'm not mistaken.
And she's in the movie. She's a new
the
character
new one,
in the movie. Yeah, yeah. And she seems like she's probably funnier than she often is, because I remember it being like super supercilious, you know, and refers to herself as this one a lot.
That's
and
how she refers to herself. Yeah.
And here she's kind of the Mr. Spock of the group, you know, because like she's like kind of an expert on everything and knows the odds for everything, you know. And it's kind of a good straight man, for lack of a better word, to kind of the crazier and more flamboyant other ones, basically.
Yeah.
And she's a martial arts expert.
Yeah. And and footnote, Englehart later brought the character with him into a Justice League story that he did for DC, and then Eclipse Comics and Image, and even a novel that he wrote called The Long Man. At least she shows up, I think, under different names, but you're supposed to intuit that it's the same character. I like that everyone kind of thinks she's nuts and kind of full of herself. You know, she kind of takes herself very seriously as a psychic and everything, until like she starts proving herself right and stepping up and proving her worth with the martial arts fighting and, you know, like kind of cutting a hole in a wall to escape at the right time and things like this. At one point, Groot is impressed. So let's talk about Groot then, who's much closer to the one we talked about in...
People who've seen the movies may be surprised that Groot speaks, you know, instead of, Groot speaks in the movies, but he says more than just, I am Groot. He talks in, you know, other sentences too. And it's kind of highfalutin, fake royal and, you know, arrogant fashion, but he's kind of going along with the group anyway, you know? And, And he and like Rocket become friends. And there's a funny part where he's, the little Groot has reunited with the team, and he's like saying, like, I demand, you know, water. I need, you know,
I need moisture.
Moisture. And so Rocket spits on him, you know, and Groot is like sputtering with outrage, you know, even though it's like, it was the most handy form of moisture at the time, you know, so.
Yeah, here we see the roots, no pun intended, of the bromance between Rocket and Groot that you see in the movie, and also the concept of Groot dying and coming back as a little kind of sprout.
Yeah.
But I love his dialogue, you know, things like, yes, this will be a glorious death, things like that. Yeah. Death Cry, it's not mentioned anywhere in the story, but this character has been around for a while, too. She showed up in the Avengers back in the 90s during Bob Harris's run, drawn by Steve Epting, if memory serves. I know Epting and Harris worked together. I don't know if he drew Death Cry or not, but this was kind of in that Rob Liefeld, Jim Lee period, you know, where everyone had jackets and, like, leg holsters and all that kind of stuff, and that had infected the Avengers a little bit, too. But it was hinted that she was the niece of Lilandra, the Empress of the Shire, and the daughter of Deathbird, who was Lilandra's.
Okay, I was wondering if she was connected to Deathbird or not. Yeah.
Yeah.
Since she gets killed in the second issue, we probably need to dwell on her too much.
No, and she's brought back from the dead in the Chaos War storyline from, like, around the turn of the decade, 2010, 2011, whenever that was, which felt very much like Marvel's attempt at the Blackest Night storyline. And then who else have we got?
I think, we've mentioned Rocket a bit, so I don't know if we need to talk anymore about Rocket, you know. And Captain Universe, I'm sort of like,
Also created by Bill Mantlo, also like Bug, originated in the Micronauts, and the idea is that there's this Uniforce that, you know, visits different people, kind of like a one-man Green Lantern wish fulfillment thing, like, you know, and the tagline was like, anyone can be Captain Universe. I think, like, at some point in the 80s or maybe even the 90s, Spider-Man gets the Captain Universe power for a while. And here, he's in this guy, Gabe Vargas, an Earth combat veteran of some sort. I don't think it says which branch of the service. And it's nice that they bring in the Captain Universe stuff, but he's kind of a cipher.
Yeah.
Even though he you know, tries to sacrifice himself, mm-hmm. and
he can't even sacrifice himself, right?
Yeah, you know? he's just kind of bland. Yeah. I will say that some of these characters work better than others, mm-hmm. As you mentioned. I feel like it's a group with a lot of fun potential. Mm-hmm. Although Giffen, who's so funny at times, like his mm-hmm. classic Justice League stuff mm-hmm. from the 80s, he plays things relatively straight. Rocket and Bug, I think, mm-hmm. both have a lot more potential than they live up to here. Mm-hmm. Although, like, Mantis comes across all right. Groot does well.
Yeah.
Captain Universe, not so much.
Yeah.
So what do we want to say about anything about the actual story itself?
Yeah, well, I feel like this first issue is kind of the highlight of it. And like there are great gags in it where it's like Quill is like starting at a target practice and they're shooting, like using like very low tech weapons. And he shoots at what looks like a standard police range, like body outline.
Yeah.
And you see it and the outline, the cardboard is like untouched and there are bullet holes all around it, you know?
Yeah.
And there's other parts where like during the team's doing stuff, there's a part where like Rocket is running around something and he says, excuse me, pardon me. And it's
leaping from like character to character.
Yeah. It's like, that's a Bugs Bunny line. You know?
Yeah.
And when Deathcry is insulted, you know, she says something like, you know, you and I will do the death dance. You know, she's like a Klingon, you know, and someone else says,
Death dance?
You know? Yeah. So, I mean, I very much associate that kind of stuff with Keith Geffen. And, you know, it reads very well. It feels, you know, kind of easygoing and kind of, you know, undermining in a light way, you know, all the kind of the Sturm und Drang of the superhero stuff, you know.
So, yeah.
So in one way, it's like the members are a little bit, well, some of them are interchangeable. So, and how it is in, you know, in the movie, it's like you've got Quill, Groot, and Rocket Raccoon, you know, and the others, you know, kind of come in, you know, and you don't really notice. It's like Deathcry isn't that different from Drax or Gamora.
Yeah.
Deathcry is just kind of psychotic, you know.
There are a couple things I want to mention real quick.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the start of the third issue mm-hmm. when Quill figures out how the Phalanx are going to kind of deliver this viral payload that mm-hmm. they have. And he does it by stopping at like a Kree computer kiosk.
Yeah.
And his password still works that Ronan gave him.
Yeah.
And he has like the lamest password skills. Like his password is just accuser. Like, no numbers or letters or special characters.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, really?
It's @QZER #pounds, you know. Yeah.
Three, yeah. But I will say one thing I like about this story is the Kree, who have this sort of superiority complex, mm-hmm. Not everyone, but you see some who like feel some gratitude to Quill /Star-Lord.
Yeah.
This Captain Chandar, who it turns out she was one of the people who he ended up saving mm-hmm. in the earlier event that caused him to renounce the Star-Lord title. Mm-hmm. So she feels a little gratitude to him. And there's almost like a low-key mm-hmm. attraction there that never goes into flirtation or anything. It's probably for the best. Mm-hmm. And in the scene in issue 4 where the Kree soldiers pretty much just sacrifice themselves mm-hmm. for the team, and the guy says, it's been an honor, you know.
Yeah.
I like those moments, you know, they're nice little grace points. I will say that like the last story, I'm not wild about the art here.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like Timothy Green 2 is his name, and I feel like it's another thing that seems like it might be better in something else, you know, because I feel kind of at arm's length from the action with it. I mean, it's interesting, you know, it's different from the usual kind of slick space stuff, but also feels like less immediate than a different kind of space opera artist would do. And so it's like, I feel detached almost.
Yeah, and as with Gene Colan, maybe not to the same degree, it feels like a mismatch. It feels like he does some things well in it, but the blazing action isn't a strong suit of his. Mm-hmm. It feels like he, you know, he might be better at more character-based stuff.
Yeah.
I don't like his Star-Lord, you know, at all, his face.
Yeah.
And also the color palette feels very monochromatic.
It does.
Different monochromes at different times, and there are whole panels that are like the same kind of greenish-brown hue or whatever, which to me kind of suggests like maybe it was rushed through, you know, which no one, you know,
maybe it's just
hopes that isn't the case.
Yeah.
But yeah, those things pull me out of it a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's a perfectly enjoyable story. It's I like the moments that they kind of pull out for the Guardians movie, like when they're introducing the characters. You know, that's a very cinematic device. It works pretty well.
Yeah, and it's funny they have like basically the same. You leave me while I save you from these tunnels part in issues 2 and 3, you know,
yeah.
and the sacrificing character lives in both of them, you know,
yeah.
So it's like, you know, I mean, I felt like, you know, this should either be like, could probably either have been like 3 issues or 5 and added some other element, you know, and some other environments, you know, and as it is, it's like, it feels like the pacing seems a little off in a way.
Yeah. So do you have anything else to say about these issues?
Well, I did want to say that these do have what is my examples of my least favorite sci-fi trope, which is the fake space profanity. and where, you know, you come up with some gleep-glop word that people use as like an expletive. And I can hear it's like dast, you know, like D apostrophe A-S-T. And there's a barking in there too, and it's like, you know, just don't, you know. It's
even as a kid with the original Battlestar Galactica, like the frack and Felger Carb, and like, why would that of all things become a profanity?
Yeah, I feel like frack works really well in the revised Battlestar, but they use it more as a verb in a way that's kind of closer to the real word, you know. So and there's a part in the Annihilation Conquest, one of the other ones where the main stories, where I think Quill says, "You scared the Badoon out of me," and it's like, that doesn't even make sense. You know?
So should we just go ahead and move into the reckoning?
Yeah, let's do our reckonings. I mean, these like when we, you know, weigh stories for inclusion in the comics canon, we like to just see if it has some combination of artistic excellence, lasting influence, or that X factor to make it irresistible. And I feel like we're probably on the same page with both of these.
Yeah.
And I'll jump in and you can add, but I feel like neither of us are probably inclined to feel like these are comics canon worthy stories. You know?
No, and certainly the second one comes closer, but it's not quite there. It's very enjoyable, but it's not the first thing you think of when you think Guardians of the Galaxy.
I feel like the page that has, you know, the Groot and Rocket page I was talking about with that, you know, that I almost would have it alone. But the rest of it is like, I like this, you know. Yeah. You know, I can see why it's like, we're enjoying this. Let's, you know, take this and run with it.
No, certainly that, no offense to Gene Colan, and we, you know, we both said he's great in other things. There's not a lot of artistic excellence in that first story. And even some of the stuff that I like about it feels like an accident. I don't know that, you have the diverse characters and they're not really misfits or outcasts. Mm-hmm. They're more like soldiers. They're like resistance fighters or as opposed to this later team, which is very much a Dirty Dozen kind of thrown together band of misfits, what have you. I like the way you have these different character types and personality types, but it doesn't feel like that much thought was put into it. The first one just feels kind of unexceptional. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, and it's not the only time that like the origin story of a character from the 60s or what have you, you know, is more underwhelming than the stories that would follow afterward.
Yeah.
The second one, close, but no canon.
Yeah, if it had a great artist who was a great space opera artist, I might change my mind completely, you know, because because that would make a big difference, you know. But as it is, it's like, you know, well, you know, kind of great team with sort of standard story and art that's interesting. But it almost seems like you could do a good espionage story with this artist or something like that, like a grounded real world kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, but you're right. And we don't talk about this enough, I think, how much of a difference the right artist makes. I think that Keith Giffen is a decent enough writer here that with the right visuals, this could be twice as good or more. Like, it just be a lot better story. Yeah. All right, and so I guess, sorry, Guardians of the Galaxy, but at this time, we don't have any openings for you in the comics canon. We'll get back to you.
I think that they'll, I think the Guardians are going to be okay. I think we'll hear from these guys again. Well, maybe we should go to our letters page.
So now it's time for Canon Fodder, our segment where we share correspondence from listeners like you. And we've had quite
Send in a letter to suggest a better name for our letters page, perhaps.
I like Canon Fodder, but whatever. I seem to remember you liking it, but that's okay. Taste can change.
It's like in The Simpsons, when they have the barbershop quartet, the B-sharps, and say it's a name that sounds cute at first, and you get more and more dissatisfied with it.
So we have a couple of entries from Twitter. The first is from a Matthew Cool Dog, K-U-H-L. Mm-hmm. And back at the end of March, he tweeted, hashtag tripod, at the Comics Canon is a fun and accessible podcast about comics. Now, it's been a while since we recorded because of spring break and some other things. We kind of stockpiled episodes before a little break in March. So Tripod was this thing, kind of a month-long attempt to get new people into listening to podcasts. If you listen to NPR at all, you might have heard quite a few ads or, you know, mentions of it, trying to get people interested in NPR podcasts and others. And so this guy was nice enough to recommend us, which was great. Then another one more recent, at JJ Camp, tweeted earlier this month in April, at the Comics Canon, advertising still works on me, apparently. Heard about you from Word Balloon. Really enjoying the conversations. Thanks. So we had advertised on the Word Balloon podcast, and this guy found us through that. So I'm assuming other people did too. So that's good to hear. We also have a new iTunes review. 4 stars.
Cool.
By R. Hotch. And the headline, great knowledge,
whew,
but constant you knows a little hard to listen to. It goes on to say, I'm not familiar with the two hosts of this show, but their knowledge of and enthusiasm for the content they cover is really great.
Yes.
The only downside is that one of the two hosts says, you know, almost constantly, and it gets a little tiresome to listen to.
Ugh.
But to be fair to them, neither of them... Neither of them pretend to be accomplished presenters or broadcasters, and you will for sure enjoy the content and quality of their opinions, knowledge, and appreciation for comics in general, and the specific stories and arc they cover.
All right.
I prefer to think of that more as your catchphrase. So, but we appreciate that. We do ask people to be honest, although, you know, You can have reservations and still throw in a fifth star.
I'll take a 4-star review. You
know? Sure. Yeah. I'm just saying that, you know, all of these help kind of boost our rankings in iTunes and help people find us. And we don't have a lot. We would like to have a lot more, but anything helps really. So yeah, please continue writing in and leaving reviews. It all helps. So let's then go into the spinner rack, which is our recommendation segment, where we talk about things that may, but not always, are in some ways related to the topic that we've discussed this episode.
I'll go first, and it's more tangential related, but you actually mentioned it in passing in what you discussed. I'm recommending Justice League International, which was kind of a run of obviously Justice League stories from the late 1980s, written by Keith Geffen and J.M. DeMatteis and drawn by Kevin McGuire. And there's kind of a reputation for like the comics of that era as sort of getting a lot more grim and broody and all that. And this is kind of a notable exception where they're very light and bantery. And there's even lots of like the books look brighter even, you know, there's a lot more like, seem to be a lot more like kind of white around the panels. And yeah, they feel very much like the current light Marvel books and have a similar kind of bannering quality. I remember there's a storyline where the Injustice League or someone like that had a prop battle with the League. And at the end, their head was being taken away by the prisoners, you know, and John Jones, the Martian Manhunter says, you know, it's like, and by the way, your use of the name Justice League counts as a copyright infringement. Your lawyers will be hearing from our lawyers, you know. So
was it the Injustice game? I don't remember which one.
Yeah. But I remember the line, and this is kind of how it introduced that the Martian Manhunter had like a weakness for Oreos, you know.
Right.
So they're a lot of fun, and if you're looking for kind of like light comic fare that, you know, younger readers will enjoy, that's a great example.
Yeah, and one of my favorite bits from that is the confrontation between Batman and Guy Gardner, mm-hmm. who's the Green Lantern at that period. Batman knocks him out with one punch, mm-hmm. and like that's a favorite catchphrase. Like, I think it's the Blue Beetle just yells out "one punch," and they just starts laughing hysterically. Okay, so mine are a little more related. I have two. My first is the aforementioned Guardians of the Galaxy run by Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning, specifically Volume One, Legacy. With art by Paul Pelletier, I want to say it's pronounced. I also like Abnett and Lanning's Nova from around the same period. I recommend both of those really strongly. And as I said, there's a lot of stuff in that first Guardians issue that obviously you have Gamora is on the team in Drax at that point, and you know, Nowhere with a K, the giant floating head, disembodied head of a celestial that is their headquarters. And I will say that one thing that disappoints me about the movies is the absence of Cosmo, the Russian dog that was sent into space and is sort of the runs Nowhere and telepathically hangs out with the heroes, and this is still very much a dog, like runs around at their heels, very excited and happy to be with them.
Well, right, Cosmo does have the cameo in it, you know, where he's like with the collector's face, and he like licks the collector's face at the in the tag at the end with Howard the dog, you know.
So he doesn't talk telepathically
or otherwise.
So the second, or perhaps I should say third thing I'm going to recommend is The Micronauts, specifically issues 1-12 from that Marvel run in the 70s. By Bill Mantlow and Michael Golden. That first year tells a pretty cool space opera story, and it introduces both Bug and Captain Universe, who we've mentioned in the latter story. And I'm just a huge fan of space opera comics in general. Guardians, Nova, even the War of Kings storyline that toward the end of their run, Ed Brubaker's Rise and Fall of the Shire Empire from Uncanny X-Men, which you didn't care for all that much.
That was okay.
Yeah. Green Lantern, Nexus, and on. So I want to throw this out to you listeners. Let's make a list. What are your favorite space-based comics? It could be Adam Strange, you know, Flash Gordon, maybe the recent run from Dynamite Comics, the Valerian graphic novels. We have that movie coming out later this summer. Matter Barons by Jodorowsky. Like, whatever it is, let me know. Yeah. Like, let me know your favorite space opera comics. Yeah. Recommend something to me that I may not have read.
Yeah, the Green Lantern, the Sinestro War, maybe an episode in the future. Well, speaking of space operas, and in this case, mythological space operas, next time we're going to talk about Thor issues 1-8, and these are the Thor, the Goddess of Thunder storyline, wherein a mysterious woman, you know, basically takes the hammer and the mantle of Thor, and, you know, the Odin son, the former Thor, tries to find out who it is. And, you know, I won't spoil it till we get to the end of that, you know, storyline, but it's, you know, 1 through 8, and it's a really, you know, fun recent storyline that, you know, that we really want to dig into.
Yeah, and this is an opportune time. If you follow comic book news at all, you might have heard that an executive at Marvel, David Gabriel, I believe his name is, made some comments referring to Marvel's diverse line of superheroes, caused a little bit of a stir on the internet. And so we thought it'd be a good time to talk about one of those diverse titles where you have kind of a female or a person of another ethnicity taking on a classic mantle. Like, you have Sam Wilson, Captain America, you have the new Ms. Marvel, Kamala Khan, you have this female Thor, things that have, you know, been controversial in certain pockets of comics readership.
A non-traditional take on a traditionally, like, white male character, basically.
And we've done, certainly we did Ms. Marvel, but this feels like a good, fresh time for us to talk about something we've both wanted to.
We were talking about this already, and then it's like, well, this is a great reason to do it, you know.
Yeah. So, that should be fun. We're really looking forward to that one.
Yeah, so meanwhile, the Comics Canon can be found on the hoary hosts of podcasting, iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher, as well as our website, comicscanon.com.
And we want to hear from you, dear readers. As I said, rate and review the show on iTunes. It helps us out a lot. You can also email us at letters@comicscanon.com. You can post or comment on our Facebook page or hit us up on Twitter, as those two readers did, @TheComicsCanon. Do any of those things and we'll read your correspondence in a future episode. This podcast was produced by Grayson Bergman. For The Comics Canon, I'm Kevin Morrow.
And I'm Kurt Holman. The Comics Canon will be continued next time with Thor, Goddess of Thunder.